You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 193 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Problems of Society, An Esoteric View, From Luciferic Past to Ahrimanic Future, translated by Matthew Barton, 10 lectures. This is Lecture 8, given in Berlin on the 14th of September, 1919. As I said, our current era in humanity's evolution is one that faces us with great trials, even if a great part of what undergoes these trials unfolds in the subconscious depths of the human soul. People know, and must know, what it means to cross the threshold into the invisible world when they undergo a form of initiation and really do enter this invisible world. Yet something similar is also at work, though naturally not all at once, but over longer spans of time, with the whole of humanity. The interwoven powers of thinking, feeling, and will gradually become independent as humanity crosses the threshold into supersensible worlds. These powers will separate, in a sense, will extricate themselves from each other in human experience. All this is connected with significant changes in our deepest human nature, changes which must begin to be integrated into our awareness. Yet today people are drawn instead toward the comfort of ignoring what is actually happening within humanity. They give themselves up to illusions and mere dreams, really, about life. And this is a tendency we have to overcome. What I wish to say to you today is something best comprehended if we recall realities of existence that have long been familiar to us. The departure of our I, capital, and astral nature from physical and etheric bodies when we fall asleep, and our return to them when we awaken. This is a general and in some respects schematic way of describing what happens. In general, we can say that on awakening, we re-enter our physical body and ether body. But in a sense, this re-entry occurs to diverse degrees. If, for instance, we consider a young child, we can never say that his eye and astral body completely immerse themselves in the physical and etheric bodies, and that their action is merged entirely with that of the physical and etheric. In a sense, something of the I and astral body does not unite with the physical and etheric. And if we look back to earlier times of humanity's evolution, before that incisive turning point in our evolution, which, as I said, lies in the middle of the 15th century, then we can see that until then the I and the astral body did not fully immerse themselves during waking life, during periods of waking consciousness. It is of huge evolutionary significance in our post-Atlantean era that our soul and spirit, our I and astral body, can now fully immerse themselves in our physical and etheric bodies. In our present times, and later on these circumstances will again change to some degree, this happens from around the age of 27 or 28. This is a very important secret of humanity's evolution. Only now, really, do we experience ourselves as fully inhabiting the physical body, and only when we reach the mature age of 27 or 28. What is the significance of this complete immersion in the physical body? By this means, we become able to develop thoughts, unfold ideas that embody materialistic science as it has come to the fore since the time of Galileo and Copernicus. Our physical body is the right tool for these ideas, for this scientific view of the world. In former centuries, this condition was not attained in waking life, and therefore scientific thinking, in its present form, did not exist. It is entirely bound up with the physical body. And this relates to everything I have been saying to you recently about the activity we must develop in terms of spiritual scientific insights, so as to reawaken the interest of the three hierarchies of beings immediately above us, as I describe them. These beings of the three hierarchies have brought us to the point of being able to immerse ourselves in our physical body, and thus acquaint ourselves scientifically with the dead mineral world of our external environment. In our present times, it is, quite simply, the task of humanity to know about such things. Without being aware of them, we are, in a sense, sleepwalking through our era, failing to perceive the real nature of events occurring around us. These tangible realities are ones we must allow to work upon our soul so that we become aware of the nature of forces currently holding sway in humanity's evolution. In our age, by which I mean, of course, a long span of time, much renewal is needed. Above all, such things as the aims of education must find renewal, as I have suggested previously. We have to educate people from childhood on, so that, at the age I indicated, they become able to immerse themselves fully in the physical body. We must make it possible for this to happen. Our efforts to transform and renew education are needed in order to prepare people to experience and undergo a new stage of evolution. If we observe life, we will know that there are many broken human beings today, people who cannot cope with life. Why can they not? It is because they are unable to look back to experiences they should have had in their school days, in their childhood. Certain powers can only be developed in childhood. If they are, they remain available throughout life as a possession, which enables us to cope with what comes at us. If we do not have these powers, we can't cope with life, quite simply. Awareness of this can give us the real sense of responsibility we should have for education and the education system. Another thing, we must be clear that the Christ impulse entered humanity in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, which began in the 8th century BC and lasted until the middle of the 15th century of our era. Roughly, after a third of this period had elapsed, the Christ impulse entered earthly evolution, the event of Golgotha, endowing it with its intrinsic meaning. This event occurred at the point when humanity was in the process of developing the rational or mind soul. This stage of evolution, during which human thinking and feeling was more instinctive than today, was followed by a stage from the 15th century, during which the consciousness soul developed. That is the stage we still find ourselves in today. The way in which the event of Golgotha entered humanity as a world historical impulse was initially adapted to the instinctive understanding of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch and was thus absorbed by the people of those times. It was quite natural for people with this kind of instinctive comprehension to think of the Christ being living within the individual Jesus of Nazareth, to conceive that this being had descended from cosmic heights in order to unite with the body of Jesus of Nazareth. Everyone was, at that time, able to recognize in the event of Golgotha a great, hugely significant, supersensible occurrence entering humanity. But as time continued, this recognition increasingly faded, as the powers at work in the rational or mind-soul dimmed. Understanding of the event of Golgotha, that still prevailed in the early Christian centuries, could not endure, but was superseded by a quite different inner state amongst civilized humanity. As the age of the consciousness soul dawned, the event of Golgotha itself was perceived in ever more material ways. Over the past 400 or 500 years, therefore, as civilization has developed, understanding of what actually happened at Golgotha, the indwelling of Christ in Jesus of Nazareth, has continually diminished. This great mystery, instinctively perceived and acknowledged in the early Christian centuries, has receded ever further from the grasp of our understanding. It has become ever more materialized, to the point when, in our own day, people no longer give any credence to the supersensible cosmic Christ, and this is regarded as progress. Instead, people have begun to speak of Jesus of Nazareth as a person who, albeit extraordinary, was otherwise just like any other person. Here, too, we find ourselves at a point of transition. A new understanding of Christ must dawn. This new understanding can only dawn, however, if it is sought with the means offered by spiritual science, with supersensible means which alone can discover something that, while manifesting in the sensory domain, could only in fact be accomplished in the supersensible realm. This new understanding of Christ must emerge from depths of human nature in which all religious divergences and disagreements that otherwise fracture humanity fall silent. These confessional differences are all rooted in a realm of the soul that is closer to the surface, more superficial, then everything which, drawn from deeper underlying regions, must, through spiritual science, lead to a new understanding of the Christ within Jesus. And this understanding will not be complete, will not really satisfy the thirst of the modern human soul, if it does not, at the same time, bridge the divergences in humanity which the different confessions have bred. Of this new Christ impulse, we may hope for something that we all must yearn for, really, if we think of humanity in a serious and worthy fashion. This is sought today in other domains, but with very little understanding. Nowadays, people pin great hopes on a so-called League of Nations. It is curious how people today are drawn to abstractions as they seek to understand reality. Where should the impulses originate that can work within and between nations and connect them in a so-called League of Nations? Everything that has so far formed the basis of this League of Nations amounts to nothing but a few abstractions. But people are sleepwalking through such things. And we can see the degree to which they do so in a fact such as the following. Before America had involved itself in all the current global negotiations, Woodrow Wilson, the inventor, or at least the re-inventor, of this League of Nations, stated that the League could only be properly founded through acknowledgement that there were no victors or vanquished in this catastrophic war. That, he said, would be the indispensable precondition for the League. Anyone who took this seriously at the time cannot possibly take seriously what is now being said about this League of Nations. The two things are irreconcilable. But people fail to see this. And the fact that people accept irreconcilably contradictory things once a little time has elapsed really militates against any healthy human progress. It is as if people today are not fully inwardly present in what is happening. No, this League of Nations amounts to absolutely nothing. And this, you see, is because things that must be established in humanity must flow to the surface from the depths of human nature. Only a new recognition of the Christ impulse can develop in us something established through all civilized humanity that is not founded on the differences between nations, and only this accords with contemporary needs. This Christ impulse, comprehended in a new spiritual scientific way, is the only thing that can reunite different peoples fractured by hatred and misunderstanding. And this is something that must inscribe itself very deeply in our souls as strong conviction. Everything that tends in another direction will inhibit and obstruct humanity's evolution. Basically, it is frivolous to speak of the needs of human evolution today in any other way than out of its deepest foundations. If the earth and humanity's evolution received its true meaning and purpose through the event of Golgotha, today the time has come when this meaning and purpose must be grasped again in a new way. Unless humankind feels obliged to develop such understanding, no healing will come for the wounds of our age. The things that have to happen today cannot be seen separately from each other, but belong together. You can't, in quotes, do politics externally. You can't just set up an outward League of Nations. These things must be internalized through the Christ impulse, the deepest impulse at work in humanity. Anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is obliged to focus on what every person can and must activate within himself, simply as a single individual. You see, the moment we touch on these things, we must feel the whole seriousness of our age. It is profoundly painful to experience how little sense there is of the gravity of our times, that people avoid approaching insights of great scope and importance, which very definitely must be integrated into human awareness. We have passed through an era that has greatly diverted us away from the inner motivation that can lead us to the insights we need today. If you ask a modern scientist or someone whose thinking runs along modern scientific lines, what would have happened in Earth evolution if the human being had not been a participant in it? He will inevitably tell you, if he draws the necessary conclusions from his views and hypotheses, that the Earth would have simply evolved without us, would have evolved its mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms, irrespective of our absence. In his view, the Earth would evolve more or less as it has done in the absence of the human being. And there would therefore, of course, be no houses, cities, and such like. If we take the modern scientific perspective, we inevitably assume that the Earth would have evolved without the human being. And yet, this is entirely erroneous. If you survey all that we have discussed on various occasions over almost 2 years now, you will feel that what I now have to say is self-evident, and yet our attention does still need to be drawn to it. The physical body we bear with us is interwoven with a soul element during our existence between birth and death. Now, we have entered the current epoch. In fact, it is permeated by the soul in a particular way. The I, capital, and the astral body immerse themselves fully in the physical body. And whether our physical corpse is assigned to fire at cremation or to the earth through burial, modern science sees this merely as the diverse substances that composed this body returning to the earth at death, in accordance with principles we can study in organic and particularly inorganic chemistry. But all this is nonsense. The truth, rather, is this, that the body we inhabit from birth to death is far from untouched by the human being's soul and spirit, which leave their imprint in the body. And we assign our corpse to the earth in a form and condition that it can only have acquired because it was inhabited, from birth to death, by the entelechy that lived as human soul-spirit in the world of spirit prior to our conception. The earth, as it has evolved so far, would long since have crumbled to dust, succumbed to aridity, if it had not absorbed the leaven of human bodies, whether through burial or cremation, that have been enlivened until death by human souls. When people baked bread in the old days, nowadays this process has become a little more artificial, they kept back a little of the dough that was then used at the next baking as yeast or leaven. Similarly, the earth would not be able to evolve without human bodies, not animal ones, added to it as leaven. They ensure that the earth, which would otherwise long since have dried up and grown desiccated, can bear what it carries within it until the end of its evolution. In other words, we participate in the whole of the earth's evolution, and do so even more at the present stage of our development. What passes to the earth's evolution when we die has significance for it. In our present era and stage of evolution, and on into the future, when we reach the age of maturity after 27 or 28, we are connected with our physical body in waking life in a way that acts in a distinctive way upon the world of spirit, the supersensible world. This is the remarkable polarity in human evolution. When we pass through the portal of death, we leave our body behind, and in doing so we sunder from it something that serves the earth as the leaven of its evolution. If we have reached the age of 28 through to 35, at death we surrender to the world of spirit, something that this world of spirit needs. On a future occasion, I will show how the state of affairs is somewhat different for younger people who die before this age. That would lead us too far today. But what we surrender in this way to the world of spirit is the most important part of what we rediscover after death when we re-experience our life in reverse in the world of spirit. Secrets such as these are connected with humanity's evolution and should be absorbed and integrated into modern human awareness. Such things are really nothing at all to do with curiosity and sensationalism, but have a very, very different importance. If you can take such things seriously, experiencing their full import within you, then you can find a much more serious stance toward life than others. And this deeper sense of life's seriousness is something that modern people need. Full understanding of the aims of our threefold social organism, as opposed to outward understanding, which can and must also be communicated to the outer or exoteric world, must be founded on this sense of seriousness, which draws upon anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. This alone makes it possible to participate in modern social evolution in the most conscious and intentional way. Otherwise, we do not grasp things with sufficient depth. Things connected with social threefolding must be aired in public. But here, amongst ourselves, I hope we can kindle sufficient fire, the necessary enthusiasm, so that those who can develop such understanding from a spiritual scientific perspective can do all in their power to impart this understanding to others through the warmth of their own conviction, through their own enthusiasm. The seriousness needed nowadays will not develop through the superficial kinds of knowledge generally possessed by people today, which leads to beliefs such as that the earth can evolve perfectly well without the presence of the human being. And this is why, when we go through big cities today, Our heart bleeds to witness the complete lack of real connection in people with what is actually unfolding in human evolution. These things have been developing, and the catastrophic world war is a first culmination of the superficiality of outlook that increasingly holds sway. But our duty nowadays is to arrive at that threefold deepening I spoke of yesterday, toward the beings of the three hierarchies above us. We have to recognize that we dwell in this context of realities. As humanity, we must pass through an era in which the I and the astral body are descending most deeply into the physical and etheric bodies, and are therefore exposed to the greatest temptations due to the fact that we enter into such close connection with our physical body. There are two things to note here. Firstly, the way in which this temptation can manifest in what I will call its Western form, and secondly, its Eastern one. The Western form surfaces in ever more distinct ways as we turn our gaze toward the West, but it is a temptation which we bear very strongly in our own nature. Due to the fact that we are immersed ever more deeply in our physical body, we forge an intimate bond with the earthly forces with which the physical body is connected. Our physical body is bound up with earthly forces and can only detach itself from them by overcoming in its awareness the gravity of the earth and other such things that connect it to the earth. We have no idea of how we can overcome the forces at work in us through our organization. On one occasion here, I referred to something that can illustrate what I mean. I said that the human brain is so heavy that if its whole weight came to effect, it would crush the blood vessels immediately below it. But in fact, our organism is so remarkably configured that this brain of ours floats in the cerebrospinal fluid. In line with the Archimedean principle, a body is lightened by an amount equal to the weight of the water it displaces. For this reason, the pressure of the brain on underlying blood vessels is reduced accordingly. Because the brain floats in the cerebrospinal fluid, and we can therefore overcome the brain's weight. We overcome many things in this way. These forces, to which so little attention is paid, reveal that in the physical realm too, the human organism testifies to cosmic wonders. We are connected with the forces of the earth, but we must not become directly subject to them. The temptation to be too immediately bound up with them exists in the Occident, in all Occidental feelings about life, and this temptation is an Ahrimanic one. We can only counteract it insofar as we gradually succeed in deepening our insights to the point where we can survey the historical evolution of humanity and recognize, really understand, the mystery of Golgotha as a reality occurring at the midpoint of this evolution. The Occidental worldview can only be safeguarded against the Ahrimanic temptation and its consequences if this worldview accepts the Christ into its cognitive reflections and quest for knowledge, if Christ can enter in to all Western thinking. The Oriental worldview is in the opposite position. In some respects, Orientals retain a childlike perspective by holding back their I and astral body from fully descending into the physical and etheric body, even in the current age, when humanity is destined to engage in this descent. The Oriental flees this immersion. It is interesting to examine from this perspective, some of the most salient phenomena of modern times. Rabindranath Tagore has given some very fine speeches, which have been translated into German and other languages. If you read these and have a sense for such things, you will discover that they have a quite different flavor from anything we find when we read Western authors. A different spirit entirely. Just as Oriental paintings and drawings are different in quality from those by Westerners, so the whole mood of soul of Rabindranath Tagore is different from that of a European or an American. And this is because even an educated modern Oriental, if he has been schooled in the Orient, evades this deeper connection with the physical body. Here lies a temptation, one now of a Luciferic kind, to fail to make full use of the human physical body. Whereas an American strives to employ the full scope of the physical body, the Oriental seeks to employ it too little. This is how we should understand the psychology of diverse peoples nowadays. Decades ago, the global catastrophe might have been avoided if people had considered the relationship between the people of Western and Eastern Europe. Back in 1910, I had very good reason for speaking of the folk spirits. This lecture cycle contains various insights into elements that have contributed to the catastrophic world war of the last 5 years. In all these things, it is really a matter of preparing oneself, very seriously, so that we do not evade reality but comprehend it fully, that we place ourselves into evolution in a way that goes beyond the confines of self-involved egoism, in which we consider only our most immediate surroundings. We cannot meet the task facing us today if we do not find the goodwill to imagine ourselves at least into the whole of humanity's evolution, to be aware of what is unfolding there. This is not meant to be a critique of the past. I have often said that such a thing must inevitably appear foolish from a spiritual scientific perspective. What is necessary is the insight that we ought to think and act differently in future than we did in the past, that we must seek to carry forward into the future what emerges and becomes available to us from spiritual knowledge. In recent days, I have been speaking to you about how we should regard our whole life between birth and death. As we enter life at birth, we bring with us into sensory physical existence supersensible powers from our supersensible existence. These powers go on working. This is something that people today find very difficult to conceive of. How do they go on working? They do so in everything we develop in this physical world as the life of the mind, of human culture and spirit. If we could not bring with us at birth impulses originating in pre-birth life, there would be no possibility of having poets amongst us, or of developing a worldview or science or a human education. Spiritual cultural life originates in pre-birth existence. By contrast, what we develop from will impulses within economic life, all that we do in a sense unawares simply by participating in economic life, fraternity, love of humanity, thinking not just for ourselves but for others, working not just for ourselves but for others, supplies us with the most important impulses we bear with us back into the world of spirit. Just as we bear with us from the world of spirit powers which primarily constitute our life of spirit here on earth, so we carry back into the world of spirit the powers we develop in economic life as human love and fraternity. They accompany us and become important impulses for us there. If we study what emerges year by year in a child's life, we can find in it the legacy of what originates in the world of spirit, so that a person can unfold here his spiritual inclinations. And if we study what occurs in economic life, in the form of work performed for others through our will, at the same time, we discover in it what we bear back with us into the world of spirit when we pass once more through the gate of death. And what develops only between our birth and death appears to someone who can perceive the world of spirit as the opposite of what develops only in the spiritual world between death and rebirth. If you read what I say entitled Theosophy about soul and spirit land, you will find there an account in terms that originate entirely in living vision of conditions there. But everything that constitutes the rights state, by contrast, is the opposite of impulses at work in the life between death and rebirth. We establish our life of culture and spirit with powers that originate in the time prior to birth or conception, while we develop economic life so that we can bear the powers thus engendered into the world of spirit again. And what is developed only here and belongs to the earth alone is the political dimension, the legislative life of the state. And this has no connection with the world of spirit at all. People generally make things easy for themselves by interpreting the things involved in these domains in the way they are capable of doing. Many people today apply to present conditions the biblical phrase, quote, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's," close quote, possibly in order to hearken back a little to monarchical values in these republican times. Yet this is a phrase that cannot easily be applied to our modern times, but can only properly be understood in its intrinsic context. The Roman Caesar was himself a god in those days, and required worship owed to the divine. Caligula even demanded this divine worship by having the Greek statues brought to Rome. Only the statue of Zeus was saved, and ordering that their heads be struck off and replaced with the head of Caligula. He thought this was a fitting thing to do. When Jesus of Nazareth spoke this phrase, he intended it to mean this: give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, yet hold back something for the God you must seek in a being other than Caesar's. Many gospel passages have to be transposed rightly into our own times and interpreted somewhat differently from usual. Then we can increasingly wrestle our way through to a grasp of reality that we need today. Over these days, I undertook to highlight various aspects of our human task in the modern era, to wrestle our way through to this perception of reality, which we can only attain by regarding spiritual reality as something of equal validity alongside sensory reality. The greatest harm nowadays is caused by shutting our eyes to reality. For a long time now, people have not run politics in a, in quotes, politic way, but shut their eyes to what is real. Anthroposophically oriented spiritual science seeks something of vital importance, an opening of our eyes to reality. As one can witness nowadays, these eyes have mostly still hardly opened at all. People say the most extraordinary things, which testify to their lack of any sense of reality. Please, do not misunderstand me. I have to draw your attention to these things because they illustrate our times. Various individuals closely connected with the events that have brought such misfortune over Central Europe, which has not ended, in fact, but is only in its infancy, only revealed their true colors during the terrible events of the summer of 1918, especially also the autumn of that year. Various people who are responsible for much of this misfortune finally showed their true countenance at this point. These people found themselves in strange situations, strange because their situations had changed. I have met people who now contemplate with some regret the current situation in which these responsible individuals find themselves, but do not think of asking whether there are not, after all, countless millions of people in the world today who are suffering far more, both bodily and psychologically, than merely altered circumstances. In relation to such things, it is important to open our eyes and give serious attention to the need to perceive truly. Pie in the sky-ism means pursuing certain preferred ideas that are easy and comfortable to entertain without actually taking any account of what reality is telling us. It is not easy or comfortable to speak the truth about such things today. But having had to witness, with a bleeding heart, how things have taken their course, how pie-in-the-sky-ism had such devastating effects, whereas what looked reality squarely in the face was regarded as mere utopian idealism, I am obliged to focus on these things. Now that things stand fully revealed in the light of day in our tormented Central Europe, our sympathy and compassion should not prevent us from pointing to fantasists such as Ludendorff, who never wanted to see reality as it is, but sought to make it conform to his own ideas of how it should be. In this realm, too, we must be clear-eyed in our perceptions of reality, of the great scope of these matters, which are not of small importance. All these attempts, in bad taste, to justify oneself before the world, amount to the bitterest accusations and complaints. No healing will come until people realize the importance of these things and the vital need to see their reality. I did not come here in order to hint at them in a subtle, tactful way. A spiritual scientific movement is of serious import, and I feel obliged to speak plainly. Our mouths had been locked as Papageno's was, and we had to stand by silently as Michaelis played out his arts of governance over the last 4 or 5 years, appointing people of utter inability to ruling posts. These things are all part of the picture, and stand there like shadows alongside the great truths which inevitably stream through all humanity. I know that many people feel wounded when one urges them to face the truth about such things, but we cannot go on putting our heads in the sand. Only by looking squarely at the truth will we find the strength that can help humanity progress. We need this strength. We need to comprehend something fundamentally at odds with the views of those who have brought humanity to such a pass. We have to have the courage to grasp things anew. And what I have said here and elsewhere in anthroposophic gatherings is a preparation for doing so. I had no wish to offer a better kind of Sunday sermon, if you like, but to convey to you the earnest needs of our time. To be an anthroposophist, in the real meaning of the word, means to be at the very pulse of contemporary developments, to seek the truth and not to make do with lies which have so gravely entangled us at present. I trust I have been able to reach your hearts with a few words with which I sought to characterize the opposite, the shadow aspect of what is needed. I was not speaking to your rational minds alone, but above all to your hearts. For the broad understanding of our age that we need must come from the heart. We must find the impulses that can set humanity upon its feet again. But to do this, we must first recognize the depth to which empty phrases have entangled us in all realms of life. Truth will come from the Spirit. Wisdom can be found in truth alone. This is something we should inscribe deeply into our souls. I have said things to describe modern human nature, specifically characterizing our era of humanity's evolution from a spiritual perspective. I have presented them because I believe that what is most necessary today can be brought home to human hearts through such things, a mood of soul which can give rise to the seriousness necessary if we are to live in service to humanity. During my stay here, I set myself the task of invoking in you a sense, a feeling of this seriousness. The end of Lecture 8.